Overshoot Loop, Evolution Under the Maximum Power Principle by Jay Hansen. Originally written in November of 2013, minor revisions in June of 2015. Three quotes, the first from Thomas Hobbes, Leviathan. In the first place, I put forth a general inclination of all mankind, a perpetual and restless desire of power after power, that ceaseth only in death. The next from John Gray, Stray Dogs. The destruction of the natural world is not the result of global capitalism, industrialization, Western civilization, or any flaw in human institutions. It is a consequence of the evolutionary success of an exceptionally rapacious primate. Throughout all of history and prehistory, human advance has coincided with ecological devastation. And H.T. Odum, in 1994, said, "It may be time to recognize the maximum power principle as the fourth thermodynamic law, as suggested by Lotka." Definitions. Politics. Noun. 1. Social relations involving authority or power. We swim in politics like fish swim in water. It's everywhere, but we can't see it. In fact, telling primates, humans or otherwise, that their reasoning architectures evolved in large part to solve problems of dominance is a little like telling fish that their gills evolved in large part to solve the problem of oxygen intake from water. Denise Delarose Cummins. Now Jay Hansen speaks. I have been forced to review the key lessons that I have learned concerning human nature and collapse over the last 20 years. Our collective behavior is the quandary that must be overcome before anything can be done to mitigate the coming global social collapse. The single most important lesson for me was that we cannot rewire, literally because thought is physical, our political agendas through reading or discussion alone. Moreover, since our thoughts are subject to physical law, we do not have the free will to either think or behave autonomously. We are political animals from birth until death. Everything we do or say can be seen as part of lifelong political agendas. Despite decades of scientific warnings, we continue to destroy our life support system because that behavior is part of our inherited DNA, RNA, etc. hardwiring. We use scientific warnings, like all inter-animal communications, for cementing group identity and for elevating one's own political status, politics. Only physical hardship can force us to rewire our collective political agendas. I am certainly not the first to make the observation, but now after 20 years of study and debate, I am totally certain. The net energy principle guarantees that our global supply lines will collapse. And he hotlinks net energy principle. The rush to social collapse cannot be stopped no matter what is written or said. Humans may never be able to intentionally avoid collapse because fundamental system-wide change is only possible after the collapse begins. But what about survivors? Within a couple of generations, all lessons learned from the collapse will be lost, and people will revert to genetic baselines. I wish it weren't so, but all my experience screams, it's hopeless. Nevertheless, all we can do is the best we can and carry on. I am thankful for the internet, where I can find others bright enough to discuss these complex ideas and help me to understand them. Today, when one observes the many severe environmental or social problems, it appears that we are rushing towards extinction and are powerless to stop it. Why can't we save ourselves? To answer that question, we only need to integrate three of the key influences on our behavior. 1, biological evolution. 2, overshoot. And 3, a proposed fourth law of thermodynamics called the maximum power principle, MPP. The MPP states that biological systems will organize to increase power generation by degrading more energy whenever systemic constraints allow it. Let me say that again. The MPP, that is the maximum power principle, states that biological systems will organize to increase power generation by degrading more energy whenever systemic constraints allow it. Biological evolution is a change in the properties of populations of organisms that transcend the lifetime of a single individual. Individual organisms do not evolve. The changes in populations that are considered evolutionary are those that are inheritable via the genetic, DNA, RNA, etc., material from one generation to the next. Natural selection is one of the basic mechanisms of evolution, along with mutation, migration, and drift. Natural selection explains the appearance of design in the living world, and inclusive fitness theory explains what this design is for. Specifically, natural selection leads organisms to become adapted as if to maximize their inclusive fitness. The fitness, quote-unquote, individuals are those who succeed in generating more power and reproducing more copies of their genes than their competitors. Two of the most important methods of selection are kin selection and coalitional killing. Kin selection is the evolutionary strategy that favors the reproductive success of an organism's relatives, even at a cost to the organism's own survival and reproduction. The coalition killing of adults in neighboring groups occurs regularly in humans, wolves, and chimpanzees. Selection favors the tendency to form coalitions and kill rivals when the costs are sufficiently low. Here's the basic outline. Genes cooperate to build cells, which cooperate to build bodies, which cooperate to form coalitions and kill competing groups, which facilitates the dispersal of the winning coalition's genes into the environment. Overshoot. Energy is a key aspect of overshoot because available energy is always limited by the energy required to utilize it. Let me say that again. Energy is a key aspect of overshoot because available energy is always limited by the energy required to utilize it. Organisms are required by the second law of thermodynamics to dissipate energy. Power is energy dissipation for a purpose and equals forces times flows equals work rate plus entropy produced. Forces times flows equals work rate plus entropy produced. Organisms evolved a bias to maximize fitness by maximizing power. With greater power, there is a greater opportunity to allocate energy to reproduction and survival, and therefore, an organism that captures and utilizes more energy than another organism in a population will have a fitness advantage. Individual organisms cooperate to form social groups and generate more power. Differential power generation and accumulation result in a hierarchical group structure. Politics is power used by social organisms to control others. Not only are human groups never alone, they cannot control their neighbors' behavior. Each group must confront the real possibility that its neighbors will grow in numbers and attempt to take resources from them. Therefore, the best political tactic for groups to survive in such a milieu is not to live in ecological balance with slow growth, but to grow rapidly and to be able to fend off and take resources from others. The inevitable overshoot eventually leads to decreasing power attainable for the group with lower-ranking members suffering first. Low-rank members will form subgroups and coalitions to demand a greater share of power from higher-ranking individuals who will resist by forming their own coalitions to maintain it. Meanwhile, social conflict will intensify as available power continues to fall. Eventually, members of the weakest group, high or low rank, are forced to disperse. Those members of the weak group who do not disperse are killed, enslaved, or in modern times, imprisoned. By most estimates, 10 to 20% of all the people who lived in the Stone Age societies died at the hands of other humans. The process of overshoot, followed by forced dispersal, may be seen as a sort of repetitive pumping action, a collective behavioral loop that drove humans into every imaginable niche of our planet. Here's a synopsis of the behavioral loop described above. Step 1. Individuals and groups evolved a bias to maximize fitness by maximizing power, which requires overreproduction and overconsumption of natural resources, overshoot, whenever systemic constraints allow it. Differential power generation and accumulation result in a hierarchical group structure. Step 2. Energy is always limited, so overshoot eventually leads to decreasing power available to the group, with lower-ranking members suffering first. Step 3. Diminishing power availability creates diverse subgroups within the original group. Low-rank members will form subgroups and coalitions to demand a greater share of power from higher-ranking individuals, who will resist by forming their own coalitions to maintain power. Step 4. Violent social strife eventually occurs among subgroups who demand a greater share of the remaining power. Step 5. The weakest subgroups, high or low rank, are either forced to disperse to a new territory, are killed, enslaved, or imprisoned. Step 6. Go back to step 1, which is individuals and groups evolved a bias to maximize fitness by maximizing power, which requires overreproduction and overconsumption of natural resources, overshoot, whenever systemic constraints allow it. Differential power generation and accumulation result in a hierarchical group structure. Step 2. Energy is always limited, so overshoot eventually leads to decreasing power available to the group, with lower-ranking members suffering first. Step 3. Diminishing power availability creates diverse subgroups within the original group. Low-rank members will form subgroups and coalitions to demand a greater share of power from higher-ranking individuals, who will resist by forming their own coalitions to maintain power. Step 4. Violent social strife eventually occurs among subgroups who demand a greater share of the remaining power. Step 5. The weakest subgroups, high or low rank, are either forced to disperse to a new territory, are killed, enslaved, or imprisoned. And step 6. Repeat the process. The above loop was repeated countless thousands of times during the millions of years that we were evolving. This behavior is inherent in the architecture of our minds, is entrained in our biological material, and will be repeated until we go extinct. Carrying capacity will decline with each future iteration of the overshoot loop, and this will cause human numbers to decline until they reach levels not seen since the Pleistocene. Current models used to predict the end of the biosphere suggest that sometime between 500 million to 1.5 billion years from now, land life as we know it will end on Earth due to the combination of CO2 starvation and increasing heat. It is this decisive end that biologists and planetary geologists have targeted for attention. However, all of their graphs reveal an equally disturbing finding, that global productivity will plummet from our time onward, and indeed it has already been doing so for the last 300 million years. It's impossible to know the details of how our rush to extinction will play itself out, but we do know that it's going to be hell for those who are unlucky to be alive at the time. And then he has two quotes at the very end. From Frederick Jackson Turner, "To those who followed Columbus and Cortez, the New World truly seemed incredible because of the natural endowments. The land often announced itself with a heavy scent miles out into the ocean." Giovanni de Verrazzano, in 1524, smelled the cedars of the East Coast 100 leagues out. The men of Henry Hudson's Half Moon were temporarily disarmed by the fragrance of the New Jersey shore, while ships running farther up the coast occasionally swam through large beds of floating flowers. Wherever they came inland, they found a rich riot of color and sound, of game and luxuriant vegetation. Had they been other than they were, they might have written a new mythology here. As it was, they took inventory. And then a quote from John Gray, "Genocide is as human as art or prayer." And one last quote from Julius Caesar, "Kaisu technon, you too, my child?" Jay Hansen has extensive footnotes to this, so I'm going to go through these one at a time. The first footnote relates to this sentence. "The single most important lesson for me was that we cannot rewire, literally because thought is physical, our basic political agendas through reading or discussion alone." So the idea that thought is physical is footnote number one. He says, "The structure and function of the human mind are much different from what is taught in universities. To understand the basics, one must integrate material from multiple disciplines. Here's a sample." And he hot links to something he wrote on mind. I can read that later. Footnote number two is related to increased power. The MPP, that is the maximum power principle, states that biological systems will organize to increase power or to increase power generation by degrading more energy. So that's footnote two and then footnotes three. Footnote two is increased power generation, and then footnote three is degrading more energy whenever systemic constraints allow it. So footnote number two says, living organisms are required by the second law of thermodynamics, a law like gravity, to deplete, that is, dissipate available energy, exergy, in order to survive and reproduce. In the discipline of open system thermodynamics, living organisms are called dissipative structures because they dissipate energy. A dissipative structure is a thermodynamically open system which is operating out of and often far from thermodynamic equilibrium in an environment with which it exchanges energy and matter. When dissipative structures occur, they are required by the second law of thermodynamics to enhance local energy gradient dissipation. And this is from The Development and Evolution of the Universe by Stanley Salthy in 2010. Self-replication, or reproduction in biological terms, the process that drives the evolution of life on Earth, is one way a system dissipates an increasing amount of energy over time. As Jeremy England put it, quote, a great way of dissipating more is to make more copies of yourself. He wrote that in A New Physics Theory of Life by Natalie Walkover in January 22nd in 2014. Power is energy dissipation for a purpose, proportional to forces times flows equal work rate plus entropy produced. And that's maximum power and maximum entropy production, finalities in nature, also by S.N. Salthy, S-A-L-T-H-E, in 2010. A surplus resource is stored power. Footnote number three, which relates to the comment that degrading more energy whenever systemic constraints allow it. Footnote 3 says, originally formulated by Lotka and further developed by Odom and Pinkerton, the MPP states that biological systems capture and use energy to build and maintain structures and gradients, which allow additional capture and utilization of energy. One of the great strengths of the maximum power principle is that it directly relates energetics to fitness. Organisms maximize fitness by maximizing power. With greater power, there is greater opportunity to allocate energy to reproduction and survival, and therefore, an organism that captures and utilizes more energy than another organism in a population will have a fitness advantage. And then he hot links to the maximum power principle predicts the outcomes of two species competition experiments by John P. DeLong in 2008. Also see the continuing importance of maximum power, Charles A.S. Hall. And he hot links that. Footnote number four is related to this sentence, or this two sentences. The fitness, quote unquote, individuals are those who succeed in generating more power and reproducing more copies of their genes than their competitors. Two of the most important methods of selection are kin selection and coalitional killing. And that's footnote four, and it simply has hot link to concise example of coalitional killing and kin selection. Footnote number five is several paragraphs long, and it's related to this paragraph in the text. Politics, quote unquote, is power used by social organisms to control others. Not only are human groups never alone, they cannot control their neighbor's behavior. Each group must confront the real possibility that its neighbors will outgrow its numbers and attempt to take resources from them. Therefore, the best political tactic for groups to survive in such a milieu is not to live in ecological balance with slow growth, but to grow rapidly and to be able to fend off and take resources from others. So footnote number five says this. Not only are human societies never alone, but regardless of how well they control their own population or act ecologically, they cannot control their neighbor's behavior. Each society must confront the real possibility that its neighbors will not live in ecological balance, but will grow its numbers and attempt to take the resources from nearby groups. Not only have societies always lived in a changing environment, but they always have neighbors. The best way to survive in such a milieu is not to live in ecological balance with slow growth, but to grow rapidly and be able to fend off competitors as well as take resources from others. To see how this most human dynamic works, imagine an extremely simple world with only two societies and no unoccupied land. Under normal conditions, neither group would have much motivation to take resources from the other. People may be somewhat hungry, but not hungry enough to risk getting killed in order to eat a little better. A few members of either group may die indirectly from food shortages via disease or infant mortality, for example. But from an individual's perspective, he or she is much more likely to be killed trying to take food from the neighbors than from the usual provisioning shortfalls. Such a constant world would never last for long. Populations would grow and human activity would degrade the land or resources, reducing their abundance. Even if, by sheer luck, all things remained equal, it must be remembered that the climate would never be constant. Times of food stress occur because of changes in the weather, especially in the course of several generations. When a very bad year or series of years occurs, the willingness to risk a fight increases because the likelihood of starving goes up. If one group is bigger, better organized, or has better fighters among its members, and the group faces starvation, the motivation to take over the territory of its neighbor is high because it is very likely to succeed. Since human groups are never identical, there will always be some groups for whom warfare as a solution is a rational choice in any food crisis, because they are likely to succeed in getting more resources by warring on their neighbors. Now comes the most important part of this overly simplified story. The group with the larger population always has an advantage in any competition over resources, whatever those resources may be. Over the course of human history, one side rarely has better weapons or tactics for any length of time, and most such warfare between smaller societies is attritional. With equal skills and weapons, each side would be expected to kill an equal number of its opponents. Over time, the larger group will finally overwhelm the smaller one. This advantage of size is well recognized by humans all over the world, and they go to great lengths to keep their numbers comparable to their potential enemies. This is observed anthropologically by the universal desire to have many allies and the common tactic of smaller groups inviting other societies to join them, even in times of food stress. Assume for a moment that by some miracle one of our two groups is full of far-sighted ecological geniuses. They are capable of keeping their population in check and, moreover, keep it far enough below the carrying capacity that minor changes in the weather or even long-term changes in climate do not result in food stress. If they need to consume only half of what is available each year, even if there's a terrible year, this group will probably come through the hardship just fine. More important, when a few good years come along, these masterful ecological people will not grow rapidly because to do so would mean that they would have trouble when the good times end. Think of them as the ecological equivalent of the industrious ants. The second group, on the other hand, is just the opposite. It consists of ecological dimwits. They have no wonderful processes available to control their population. They are forever on the edge of the carrying capacity, they reproduce with abandon, and they frequently suffer food shortages and the inevitable consequences. Think of this bunch as the ecological equivalent of the carefree grasshoppers. When the good years come, they have more children and grow their population rapidly. 20 years later, they have doubled their numbers and quickly run out of food at the first minor change in the weather. Of course, had this been a group of noble savages, quote-unquote, who eschewed warfare, they would have starved to death and only a much smaller and more sustainable group survived. This is not a bunch of noble savages. These are ecological dimwits, and they attack their good neighbors in order to save their own skins. Since they now outnumber their good neighbors 2-1, the dimwits prevail after heavy attrition on both sides. The good, quote-unquote, ants turn out to be dead ants, and the bad, grasshoppers, inherit the earth. The moral of this fable is that if any group can get itself into ecological balance and stabilize its population, even in the face of environmental change, it will be tremendously disadvantaged against societies that do not behave that way. The long-term successful society, in a world with many different societies, will be the one that grows when it can and fights when it runs out of resources. it is useless to live an ecologically sustainable existence in the, quote, Garden of Eden, unquote, unless the neighbors do so as well. Only one non-conservationist society in an entire region can begin a process of conflict and expansion by the grasshoppers, quote, unquote, at the expense of the Eden-dwelling ants. This smacks of a Darwinian competition, survival of the fittest, between societies. Note that the fittest, quote-unquote, of our two groups were not the more ecological. It was the one that grew faster. The idea of such Darwinian competition is unpalatable to many, especially when the bad folks seem to be the winners. And then he has pages 73 through 75, Constant Battles, Why We Fight, by Stephen A. LeBlanc, St. Martin Press, 2004. Footnote number 6 is related to this sentence. Eventually, members of the weakest group, high or low rank, are forced to disperse. Here's the footnote. Dispersal is important in biology. Many amazing biological devices have evolved to ensure it, such as the production of fruits and nectar by plants and the provision of tasty protuberances called elaiosomes by seeds to attract insects. Often a species will produce two forms. One, a maintenance phenotype, the outcome of genes and the structure they produce interacting with a specific environment, that is adapted to the environment in which it is born. And two, a dispersal phenotype that is programmed to move to a new area and that often has the capacity to adapt to a new environment. According to the present theory, humans have developed two dispersal phenotypes in the form of the prophet and the follower. The coordinated action of these two phenotypes would serve to disperse us over the available habitat. This dispersal must have been aided by the major climatic changes over the past few million years, in which vast areas of human potential human habitat have repeatedly become available because of melting of ice sheets. The dispersal phenotypes might have evolved through selection at the individual level since the reproductive advantage of colonizing a new habitat would have been enormous. They would also promote selection between groups. This is important because selection at the group level can achieve results not possible at the level of selection between individuals. One result of the dispersal phenotype includes ethnocentrism, the tendency to favor one's own ethnic group over another, and the tendency to use ethnic cleansing, quote-unquote. The other result, as previously noted, is selection for cooperation, self-sacrifice, and devotion to group rather than individual goals. Factors that promote selection at the group level are rapidly splitting of groups, small size of daughter groups, heterogeneity differences of culture between groups, and reproduction in gene flow between groups. These factors are all promoted by the breaking away of prophet-led groups with new belief systems. Oh, that's interesting. One of the problems of selection at the group level is that of free riders. These are people who take more than their share and contribute to the common good of the group, less than their proper share. Selection at the group level gives free riders their free ride. They potentially could increase until they destroy the cooperative fabric of the group. However, the psychology of the free rider, which is one of self-aggrandizement and neglect of group goals, is not likely to be indoctrinated with the maze way of the group, nor is it likely to be converted to the new belief system of the prophet. Therefore, theoretically, one would predict that cults and new religious movements should be relatively free of free riders. Such an absence of free riders would further enhance selection at the group level. Moreover, this is a testable theoretical proposition. Cult followers have been studied and found to be high on schizotypal type traits, such as abnormal experiences and beliefs. They have not yet been tested for the sort of selfish attitudes and behaviors that characterize free riders. If a large cohort of people were tested for some measure of selfishness, it is predicted that those who subsequently joined cults would be low on such a measure. Predictions could also be made about future cult leaders. They would be likely to be ambitious males who were not at the top of the social hierarchy of their original group. If part of why human group split in general is to give more reproductive opportunities to males in the new group, it can also be predicted that leaders of the new religious movements would be males of reproductive age. Female cult leaders are not likely to be more fertile as a result of having many sexual partners, but their sons might be in an advantageous position for increased reproduction. Conclusion. The biobehavioral science of ethology is about the movement of individuals. We have seen that change of belief system has been responsible for massive movements of individuals over the face of the earth. Religious belief systems appear to have manifest advantages both for the groups that espouse them and the individuals who share them. It is still controversial whether belief systems are adaptations or byproducts of other evolutionary adaptive processes. Regardless of the answer to this question, the capacity for change of belief system, both that seen in the prophet and also that seen in the follower, may be adaptations because they have fostered the alternative life history strategies of dispersal from the natal habitat. Moreover, change of belief system, when it is successful in the formation of a new social group and transfer of that group to a, quote, promised land, unquote, accelerates many of the parameters that have been thought in the past to be too slow for significant selection at the group level, such as eliminating free riders, rapid group splitting, heterogeneity between groups, and reduction of gene transfer between groups. Natural selection at the group level would also favor the evolution of the capacity for change of belief system, so that during the past few million years, we may have seen a positive feedback system leading to enhanced cult formation and accelerated splitting of groups. This may have contributed to the rapid development of language and culture in our own lineage. And he quotes, and he has linked as a resource, The Biology of Religious Behavior, edited by J. Fearman, pages 184 through 186. Footnote number 7 is related to this sentence. Those members of the weak group who are not dispersed are killed, enslaved, or in modern times imprisoned. So footnote 7, The Evolution of Coalitional Killing, and that's hot linked somewhere, Richard Wrangham. Here's the abstract. Warfare has traditionally been considered unique to humans. It has therefore often been explained as deriving from features that are unique to humans, such as the possession of weapons or the adoption of a patriarchal ideology. Mounting evidence suggests, however, that coalitional killing of adults in neighboring groups also occurs regularly in other species, including wolves and chimpanzees. This implies that selection can favor components of intergroup aggression important to human warfare, including lethal raiding. Here, I present the principal adaptive hypothesis for explaining the species distribution of intergroup coalitional killing. This is, quote, the imbalance of power hypothesis, which suggests that coalitional killing is the expression of a drive for dominance over neighbors. Two conditions are proposed to be both necessary and sufficient to account for coalitional killing of neighbors. One, a state of intergroup hostility, and two, sufficient imbalances of power between parties that one party can attack the other with impunity. Under these conditions, it is suggested selection favors the tendency to hunt and kill rivals when the costs are sufficiently low. The imbalance of power hypothesis has been criticized on a variety of empirical and theoretical grounds, which are discussed. To be further tested, studies of the proximate determinants of aggression are needed. However, current evidence supports the hypothesis that selection has favored a hunt-and-kill propensity in chimpanzees and humans, and that coalitional killing has a long history in the evolution of both species. Also under footnote number 7, he has Joshua Duntley and David Buss's The Plausibility of Adaptations for Homicide, hot linked. And then in Science Daily, January 17, 2014, Violence, Infectious Disease, and Climate Change Contributed to Indus Civilization Collapse. The results of the study are striking, according to Robbins Shug, because violence and disease increased through time, with the highest rates found as the human population was abandoning the cities. However, an even more interesting result is that individuals who were excluded from the city's formal cemeteries had the highest rates of violence and disease. Footnote number 8 is related to this sentence. By most estimates, 10 to 20% of all the people who lived in Stone Age societies died at the hands of other humans. Footnote 8, he says, he has The Slaughter Bench of History by Ian Morris in The Atlantic, April 11th, 2014, and he hotlinks that. Footnote number 9 is related to this sentence. The above loop, that six-step loop that I read twice, the above loop was repeated countless thousands of times during the millions of years that we were evolving. So footnote 9 says, my discussion will revolve around two basic propositions regarding long-term human population history. One, the near zero growth rates that have prevailed through much of prehistory are likely due to long-term avenging across periods of relatively rapid local population growth, interrupted by infrequent crashes caused by density-dependent and density-independent factors. And two, broad changes in population growth rates across subsistence modes in prehistory are probably best explained in terms of changes in mortality due to the dampening or buffering of crashes rather than significant increases in fertility. And then he has in parentheses subsistence strategies and early human population history, an evolutionary ecological perspective by James L. Boone, 2002. Also see, he says, a persistent theme in much anthropological writing is the concept of the deliberate control of population numbers by hunter-gatherers so as to achieve moderate family size, adequate nutrition, and constrained adult mortality. This paper examines the mix of theory and field evidence leading to this conclusion and finds the case not proven. It argues, on the contrary, that Malthusian constraints can operate, and probably did operate, to produce a society where most adults were reasonably robust and healthy, even though child mortality was high and life expectancy short. It draws attention to the fact that the absence of population limitation in pre-Neolithic times implies high mortality as well as high fertility, and weakens the argument positing a Neolithic mortality crisis. And then he has as a reference Pre-Transitional Population Control and Equilibrium by John C. Caldwell and Bruce K. Caldwell in Population Studies, Volume 57, Issue 2, 2003. Overshoot and collapse is common. See Human and Nature Dynamics, H-A-N-D-Y, Human and Nature Dynamics, Modeling Inequality and Use of Resources in the Collapse or Sustainability of Societies. And that's hotlinked. And then the last two footnotes, footnote number 10 is related to carrying capacity will decline. And the footnote has Peter Hartley, 1993, Sustainable Engineering, Resource Load Carrying Capacity and K-Phase Technology. And then footnote 11 relates to this paragraph. Current models used to predict the end of the biosphere suggest that sometime between 500 million and 1.5 billion years from now, land life, as we know it, will end on Earth due to a combination of CO2 starvation and increasing heat. It is this decisive end that biologists and planetary geologists have targeted for attention. However, all of their graphs reveal an equally disturbing finding, that global productivity will plummet from our time onward, and indeed it has already been doing so for the last 300 million years. And the support to that is Peter Ward's 2009 book, The Medea Hypothesis, Is Life on Earth Ultimately Self-Destructive? Pages 118 and 119.